Hello and welcome to Industry Leaders, where today I'm joined by a very special guest, Vic Lee. Welcome, Vic. Thank you so much for joining. Welcome. Would you mind telling us a bit about yourself, Vic?
Yeah, sure. Hi, Nikki. Hi, everyone. My name is Vic Lee, and I'm an artist, illustrator, and storyteller from London. I'm based in my little studio in Camberwell in southeast London at the moment, and I'm obviously completely locked away from everybody else. So this is my little dungeon, where all the magic happens. It's a crap saying, isn't it? But it's true. So yeah, that's me.
And so at what point in your life did you decide you wanted to become a creative? Was there ever a defining moment for you? Were you always someone that as a child was quite creative, or?
Yeah, so as a kid, I mean, I was born, so a little bit about my history, because I think it's really important. I think it's nice to hear about people sort of now, but I think the person I am today is based on who I was, or how I started. So I was raised by my dad, me and my sister, because my mom passed away from cancer when I was three. So my dad never remarried. He was an immigrant as well. He's from Malta. So we had quite a tough upbringing on a council estate back in the day. So I kind of, you know, I learned a lot from my dad. He was an engineer and built and made things. But he used to come home with reams of engineering paper and pencils. So I used to sit in, because I was a really shy kid, which you probably couldn't tell nowadays. But I was I would burn up red, go really shy. And I, you know, I was bullied at school as well because I had little National House specs and ginger hair, and I was a proper skinny little kid. So I went through it all, but I think the where I grew up and how I grew up really made me the person I am today through my experiences. But it also made me a person that was maybe stronger willed as well. So I definitely came away from my childhood more determined to do something with my life. I didn't know what, obviously, I was a kid, but you know. But yeah, no, my creative career started when I was 30. Before that, I was a postman, a decorator. I worked in a petrol station. I was a sales assistant. I served coffee at Cafe Rouge. You know, I've done loads of jobs. And then when I was 27, I decided to take a step back. I was living in Leeds at the time. I also worked on a board of a cruise ship for 3 years as well. So I traveled around the world, got that out of the way. And then when I was 27, I thought I need to, you know, as you do when you're in your 20s, I need to think about the future. So I went to university and studied graphic design. And yeah, that was the start of my creative career, basically. I was 27, leaving when I was 30. And then coming back to London, and I've been here ever since. So yeah, that was the start, really. You know, a colourful background, but those experiences really made me appreciate the person that I am today, but also the work that I do today and the people that I deal with on a day-to-day basis. You know,
Yeah, that is really inspiring, because a lot of these talks that I've run, I've realised that industry leaders and people that are very successful, it's a lot of grit and resilience, and often a backstory of something that has happened that's instilled that in that person, that's driven them through their career. Because to be a creative and to be successful, it's hard. You know, there's a lot of obstacles that you have to overcome. And that's great to know that you actually, at 27, decided to train to be a graphic designer, because I know a lot of people think that sometimes if they start later in life, then they can't build a successful career out of being a creative or designer. So how did you then pivot from being trained to be a graphic designer to then an illustrator and an artist?
I started my working career when I was 30, really cool agency down in East London. And then I sort of moved up through the ranks. I went freelance for about 7-8 years. So I worked with a lot more agencies. But I was I'd say I was a good designer because I could take a brief and I could, because I'm a visual person in my head, I can look at things inside here and then work things out. And that's how I've always worked. So I can kind of compartmentalize quite a lot. So I started when I was 30, and then I got to 44, and 43, 44. And I thought to myself, I don't know if I want to be a 50-year-old graphic designer. So I was already thinking ahead, but I didn't know what to do. So I was like 43, 44. And I started, I'd done this really massive contract with an agency. And I ended up looking after quite a lot of the client work myself and heading teams. Even though I was a senior designer, I ended up taking over the creative director's role. So we were working on projects with Coca-Cola and Colgate Palmolive and, you know, Philips Lighting. And then I just got a bit burnt out, I think. So I took some time off, and I lived in East Dulwich at the time. So I started, I remember I was sitting in a cafe. This is how it all started. So I was sitting in a cafe in East Dulwich, and it was a really lovely summer's day. And I looked out and I thought, God, it'd be great to draw this, just to draw this street, you know? So that's what I did. I sat down. I photographed each of the buildings along Lordship Lane, and I hand illustrated all the buildings and the flats and the houses and the shops, mainly the shops. And I put it onto a local forum, the East Dulwich Forum, as a limited edition print. It was a screen print of, I can't remember now, I think it was about 500, but I'd only printed about 100. And I just thought, well, I'll choose a number, but, you know, limited edition of 500, just in case they do sell. So I put it on this forum, and then the emails started coming in. It was like literally ping, 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 and people were buying them. So, and I was just like, oh, crap, what do I do now? So I ended up buying rolls, and every weekend I would then roll the prints up, and I would hand deliver these prints around East Dulwich, Camberwell, Herne Hill, Peckham, and people would give me money on the doorstep. So I like to call myself an art dealer, because I was giving them a product and they were giving me money. Yeah. And I had a little Renault Clio at the time, and I was driving around for like 4 or 5 hours delivering these prints and then just stuffing money into my glove box. And I did this for like every weekend. I was single at the time, but I was drawing. I was still working as a graphic designer. Then I would drive up to East London, screen print them, and then I would do shows at the weekend. So I was basically working 7 days a week from, you know, 9 a.m. till, you know, 10 p.m. for about 8 months, 7-8 months. I didn't stop, but I loved it. And then eventually I thought, well, I need to, these are selling. And then I did more streets all around Broadway Market, Portobello Road, Columbia Road. It just went all over London, and they were selling worldwide. So all of a sudden I was selling thousands of prints a year. I set up a web shop, and that's when I thought, okay, maybe I should become an illustrator then. So that's kind of how it all started. And then with everything I do, one thing leads to another, and it sort of escalates. What I find with what I do is it escalates incredibly quickly, because I think I take a lot of chances. And with the book, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, you know, that was a chance. Everything I do is a bit like, there's something here, so why don't I push it further and see how far it's going to go, really. And it often just escalates a little bit beyond my control sometimes.
Yeah, well, this is it. Like, the book is amazing. We will get onto that later. But fortune does favour the brave. And I think if you're anyone that's ever prepared to put themselves out there and try something and explore and see where it goes, you just never know where it can lead. And that's why a lot of creatives that have like side hustles or passion projects, I know Lydia Pang, global design director at Nike, she does all these passion projects and like I almost see your illustration work started off as that, where it can actually reinvigorate your creativity and your love for what you do. And then it's quite an interesting way that you did that at the weekend, managed to sell enough prints to then decide that's something you wanted to focus on more.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, it was great. I managed, I took the decision to then get a studio. So I thought, if I'm going to take this seriously, I need to get a studio. So I got a little studio in St. John's Square at the old Craft Central. And ironically, I sold one of the prints that I did in Exmouth Market to the head of the Zeta Group, Mark Sainsbury. And Natalie, who was the lady that worked at Zeta, got in contact and said, would you like to do a commission? We're opening the Zeta townhouse on St. John's Square. And I thought, yeah, this would be great fun to do. My very first paid commission. They got it for an absolute song, I have to say. So I drew it, got printed, and then about six months later, I got my first studio at Clark at Craft Central on St. John's Square. And I was on the second floor on the corner. And I kid you not, I moved in, looked out of this window, and it was the exact illustration that I'd drawn of the Zeta Hotel, because I was overlooking the Zeta. So this, I could show you pictures if I had them here, but the exact positioning of the Zeta was my view from my studio, which I'd moved into. So I'd almost created this kind of walk-in art piece without actually knowing. And I stayed there for about 3 or 4 years and moved studios. But that was almost like fate. I kind of liked stories like that, because you almost think, oh my God, I've actually moved into my first commission. How amazing is that?
That's incredible. And you had no idea when you bought the studio. It's only like afterwards when you sat there and looked out the window and realised what you'd done.
Yeah. And I held the commission up at the Zeta Hotel, and I looked out the window and thought, I'm actually sitting in the place that I drew. But it was just crazy. So that, you know, you never know what life sort of, I guess, hands you. And you just got to go with it, haven't you? And that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, you do, definitely. And especially in the pandemic, like, where there's been so many people that have shown grit and resilience, such as yourself with the Corona Diary, and which I will get onto in a bit. I just want to ask you a bit more about other stuff first. So how did you then get your next clients? Because you've done so much stuff. Like, you've done like big murals, and you've done like little bits and pieces. And how do you get that work and those clients?
So I have this philosophy that a lot of people work, especially creatives, on the here and now, and illustrators do as well. And which is completely understandable, that you get a project in and you look at it and go, well, I'm not being paid enough, so I'm not going to do it. And that's understandable. You know, I've done that a few times. But the way I look at projects and work is, if somebody comes to me and says, that we want you to do this, we've only got this budget, I won't just go, well, it's all about the money. I'll go, well, okay, if I do this, then who's going to see it, and where will it lead in like 2, 3, 4 years time? I don't think about where's it going to lead in a week's time. I think about where is it going to lead in about 3 or 4 years time. I've been working on the prints, and there was a little place called Planet Partitioning, which was on Goswell Road in Clerkenwell, which is just around the corner from the studio. And they said, look, we're doing Clerkenwell Design Week. Do you want to come and draw on our window? We love the typographic things that you do. Do you want to come and draw on our window? And I was like, yeah, all right, you know. But I thought, well, who's going to see it? Clerkenwell Design Week. There's thousands of designers who are going to be milling past the window. And I'll be there live drawing on this window doing what I do. So I was like, yeah, cool. It wasn't brilliantly paid, but I got a lot of exposure out of it. And then because I had that, there was another little project as well, which I did for Halo Cabs through a friend. And I think one of the biggest things that I did was, do you remember, did you ever go to Design Junction? the big show, the interior architectural show.
Yeah, it does definitely rings a bell.
So the design junction used to be at the old post office off New Oxford Street. It's a derelict building, and it was notorious. So we used to try and get in. Their party nights were mental. So they'd have this big interior architectural show that went on there. It was only on for like 5 days. And it was this run-down, ramshackle, massive old building where people turn up from all around the world, set up their stands and stalls. It was amazing. But their party night, the first night, you would get queues of people round the block, like for about a mile, trying to get into this crazy party. And I thought, well, do you know what? Where do I go? What do I do? How do I get more mural work? Because I was really enjoying it. So I dropped Michael, who's the head of Design Junction at the time. I just went on the website, found Michael's name, and dropped him. I said, Michael, so my name's Vic. I do murals, I sent some images. And I said, look, it's a long shot. I said, would you like me to come in and do a mural live whilst Design Junction is on? And I thought, you know, the stands were like $5,000 to $20,000. And I thought he's not even going to respond to this, but let's just put it out there. And then about a week later, he dropped me a line. He said, "Hi Vic, yeah, love to. Sounds like a great plan. Do you want to come in and have a look at the space?" So I was like, "Yeah, cool." So we went in, and there was a big cafe set up right in the middle of the venue, and obviously that's where everybody goes to this cafe. And he said, "We can't offer you much, but we've got this 14-meter wall behind the cafe. And you can do whatever you want on it. It's entirely up to you." So that's what I did. So I went in for free. I didn't get paid. I didn't pay them. It's a really lovely relationship we had. And each day there was a different coffee supplier that would come in. So I would do a mural dedicated to each of the coffee people, all the way down this 14-meter piece. Now, my reasoning for this, which a lot of people don't, I think, miss the point sometimes, is I don't go to illustration shows because it's full of illustrators. I go to interior design shows, I go to 3D shows, I go to architectural shows, because those are the people that are going to be commissioning muralists. Now, if you're the only artist at one of the London's biggest interior design architectural shows, and I'm doing a live piece, those are my audience only. So that was my reasoning. I thought, well, I'll give it a go, put myself out there, and I'll see what happens. So I did this. This was, I can't remember now, 2013, something like that. 5 days, unpaid, didn't pay them. Met just hundreds of people. From that 1 5-day stint, I think I had about 14 jobs come of it. And that was going to LA, that was doing working with Virgin Atlantic, traveled all over the UK. It's crazy, it was honestly. But you've almost, rather than follow the norm, this is the problem, this is like advertising. People do an advert, and so I'll give you a good example. We went to Vietnam a few years ago, and we got talking to this guy that we were staying with. And if you've ever been to Vietnam, I think it's Ho Chi Minh, they have streets which are dedicated to like plastic piping. Then another one will be for carrier bags, another one will be for tires, another one. Do you know what I mean? So they're all completely dedicated. And we were like, we don't understand this, because it's like they're not spread out, they're all in one place. And he said, that's the way they work here. If somebody opens a shop and it's successful selling one thing, then everyone else just copies it on the same street and sells exactly the same thing, which means no one's selling anything because there's no competition, or there's too much competition. So that's the way I look at things is, you have to step back and take away the competition and think about who you want to work with and why. And that's it. Oh, so battery low on my thing, so it might go dead in a minute.
Yeah, that's a really smart move, actually. I managed to carve myself my own niche as the only graphic design recruiter that worked with architecture practices. So I did something similar, and interior design agencies. And so clients could rely on me to call me up, and I would say, of course, I know people that have worked at like Zaha Hadid, Roger Sterk Harbour and Partners, Wilkinson Air, like you name it. I knew those creatives. And then I found that I filled those jobs really easily and really quickly because I'd carved that niche for myself rather than competing against all the other recruiters that wanted to work with the big cool agencies. And then you're just competing all the time. And that's really good advice that you've shared as well for illustrators. It's kind of like finding your niche and not putting yourself in environments where you're competing with everyone that has your skill set.
Definitely. I'm just going to plug you in. This is how.
No worries.
Because it's so spontaneous, I'm going to get another set of headphones because these have just run out.
Okay. Well, at least we get to take a look at some of your illustrations while we wait a bit.
This is me being thinking, oh, I've got everything in hand, and then everything just goes wrong. Story of my life.
It's a sign of the times. I've run one of these before, and smoke alarm kept going off, and I thought, oh god. But we're good.
There you go. I'm back.
Awesome. Ta-da. I'm gonna get on to Corona Diary now, because I just love that project, and that was how I discovered you as well. I remember seeing it everywhere and thinking, this is great. So yeah, could you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. So So the Corona Diary was, like everything in my life, an accident. It came about because I think it was around February time, you know, when everything was kicking off. So January, February 2020, I was working, I was doing projects, I was meeting clients, going around town, meeting friends for lunch and stuff. So it was everything was very normal. But we kept hearing about this little thing that was going on in Asia. And everyone's just like, oh, it's miles away, it's flu, it's this, it's that, you know, it's not really going to affect us. And I think it was when it got to Lombardy in Italy, and then they closed off the north of Italy. I suddenly thought, you know, wow, this is like really close to home. This is just across the water, really. And I started getting really anxious. Now, my partner will attest to it. If my girlfriend were here, she'd be like, yeah, he's right. So I read a lot of dystopian novels. So when this happened, and I've just finished this novel, I can't remember, it's called The Road, it was The Journey or something. And it was about a bat that basically wiped out the entire world. And then all of a sudden it came to life. I've got to stop reading books where they come to life, you know, or start reading books about happiness. So hopefully they would come to life instead. So I'd read this book. And my anxious levels were super high. So I just draw all the time. That's what I do. I'm an illustrator, I'm an artist, and you know, it just keeps me calm. So I originally did this little video. I thought to myself, well, my friend's kids. We actually went to this, my friend Joe and Kitty. It was their birthday on the 11th of March, and so I went to a yoga session with them, with Joe's husband Simon. Didn't want to, but I thought, well, I'll support Simon, you know, and we'll break our backs together. So we went on this like morning yoga session in Dulwich Village, and then we went for lunch after for coffee afterwards in the local cafe. And I was chatting to, most of my friends have got kids, so they were saying, the kids have been reading about this virus that was, you know, and the symptoms, and their kids were coming back saying, I've got a cough, I've got, you know, this, I've got that, I think I've got corona, I'm not going to school, I'm scared. And it was more the kids being anxious than the adults. The adults were just like, oh, it's nothing, it'll blow over, it's this, it's that. But I noticed it was the children that were feeling the most vulnerable and the most scared. because obviously they were reading and talking about stuff that was going on. So I did this little video. I thought to myself, well, I'll do a little 6-7 minute video about doing a diary, an illustrated diary, to jot down your feelings and your thoughts on a day-to-day basis, because it's a really nice way to pinpoint how you're feeling rather than read the news and then constantly fill your head. When you slow down and start writing the news and illustrating, it becomes much calmer to do. So I put this little video up on YouTube. I said, if schools want to get involved or parents want to get involved, just have a look. It's a little insight into doing this thing. And then I thought, well, I better start one myself, because I can't go around telling people to start something and then not have one of my own. So I did. And then, you know, as is the case with any illustrator or, you know, any creative, you share stuff on social media. So I started sharing stuff on LinkedIn and Instagram. It's the only sort of two platforms I really use. And a little flick through, little film of the first few pages of the book went on LinkedIn. I thought I'd just put it up, might get, you know, a dozen likes, and then, you know, see what happens at the end of the day. And then it just sort of blew up, this one video. And it sort of was getting thousands of views. And then it was like, you know, 20,000, 40,000, 50, 60, 100,000, 120. And it just went up. And then everyone was commenting. You know, all of a sudden it was like 10, 20, 100, you know, 1,000 people commenting, and likes were just going through the roof. And pretty much everyone said, you have to publish this. Well, I wasn't going to. It was a personal diary. But they said, you have to publish this. The way I look at it is, if somebody's got kids and they go in, say, oh, I like your diary. Why don't we publish this? Why don't we publish your diary and put it out there so that all your friends can read it and see what happens?
Yeah.
So it was a bit like that. And I thought, do you know what? Let's listen to the masses. So I did. And I just continued it. And it started from there. And then I did the one thing is that when you do stuff like this, it's really nice when people say, you've got to do this. But when you actually try and sell it, they go, I didn't really want it, really. I just thought it was a nice idea. So I built a website, because I naturally do everything myself. So I built this little pre-order website, and I'd sent it to the printers, and the printer was like, well, how many copies do you want? And I was like, can you just give it a week just to get an idea how the pre-orders go? And I put it up on the 5th of May. And I think within the first week, I'd taken, 900 orders. It was almost like it just blew up in overnight. And I was like, okay, can you do this amount, please? Mm-hmm. And that was it. So the next few months was basically me doing all of the sort of admin, writing to people, and then packaging up, driving to the post office, hand delivering them. And, you know, I mean, it was like literally 200 books a day. I was driving to the Royal Mail office, got to know everyone there, you know, got to know the postman. I've got to know so many people. It's unbelievable. So yeah, it sort of took over my life, really.
Yeah. I remember seeing, a video that you uploaded of you just like packing the diaries and all the, yeah, the boxes everywhere. And so how did you manage to remain motivated throughout this time? Because obviously there's this deadly virus in the world. It was so stressful. All of a sudden I remember seeing flickers of it on the news, and then you just couldn't get away from it. And then everyone was just like plugged in to what was happening. And how did you manage to maintain that motivation to just keep doing it all the time?
I think because I was posting more stuff up, but I realized that the book, I think, was more than I realized it was. Mm. I just thought it was a book. It was something to put out there and share, and, you know, maybe try and make a living from, because I've had one project. I've had one paid commissioning since last February, so almost a year. And I thought I need to make a living somehow doing this. And but it was, I guess it was a lot of people's encouragement through, as much as Instagram is great, I think it was probably more through LinkedIn. And it's kind of bizarre because I feel like the people that are on LinkedIn have now become my friends from afar, if you like. And I now recognize like hundreds of people's names because we communicate on a sort of like weekly basis, and they comment and I comment back. And it's really lovely to have that relationship. But I think focusing on the book, focusing on something, is really important to take your mind away from what is inevitable, what is happening to everyone, basically. And that's probably the reason why I ended up doing the second book, is because it wasn't going anywhere. I didn't want to. I mean, psychologically, mentally, it's incredibly draining to read so many harrowing stories and then draw them and illustrate them. And a friend of mine likened maybe some of my conditions to PTSD, which I think in hindsight is probably true. But I think it's the encouragement of others that kept me going, really, and realizing that the book was something that people maybe needed to read to understand the situation a little bit better. I've had quite a lot of comments from people who, from all over the world, who have said, I had no idea what was going on. I lost my father, or I lost my uncle, or, you know, and I blanked out 3 months of my life in 2020. And I bought your book, and it was great because it meant that I could revisit it in my own time, which I blanked out at the time because I didn't know what was going on. And I think messages like that are genuinely heartwarming for me.
Yeah, well, it's definitely something that I would love to have. As what you've done as an artist and as a creator is you've almost absorbed all the news and everything that's going on and then just regurgitated it and documented it in a way that's so beautifully illustrated. I've noticed, do you only create your work in black and white? Is there a reason behind that?
I often joke that I'm lazy. I'm not lazy, but so with mural work, I'll go into a place, and a lot of companies or clients will say, do you do colour? And I always say, look, here's the thing. You want me to do a mural that is 8 metres long, all hand illustrated, all crazy type of, you know, detailed. I said, you don't want this to stand out. You want it to become part of your environment, because you've got coloured carpet, you've got, you know, multicoloured chairs and tables and the things that people wear. The way I look at it is that you want this mural to become part of something without shouting. And eventually it does. You see it and you go, wow, that's amazing. But then you forget it's there. But you'll still see things in the corner of your eye. So with the black and white, I was born in 66. So I'm a black and white kid. All my family pictures are black and white. You know, I think I see things in black and white because it's a much more easier time. We are so inundated with noise and colour and screens, and, you know, everywhere around us is colour. And we subconsciously have this simpler view of black and white, whether it's black and white movies or, you know, old newspapers or comics or something like that, that we think it's an easier time and it's much more romantic. So black and white for me, it's almost like an escape from all of the noise that we're surrounded by on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think that's such a fair point. Like, there's something about your work and your style and your aesthetic that's quite therapeutic, and you're kind of looking at it and then you can choose if to look at certain details because you're choosing to, not because the colour is screaming, pay attention to me.
Yeah.
Pay attention to me because I'm bolder and more eye-catching and all the rest of it. So, so how did you go about self-publishing the book?
That's a good question. It's something that very few people actually ask. So obviously the first thing I needed to do was find a publisher. And you know, you trawl through the internet, you ask questions, but it's almost like trial and error a little bit. And I found this little place called Biddles, which are, I say a little place, they're not that little, but they're called Biddles and they're based in Norfolk. And I got in contact with them and I said, I'm thinking about doing this book, blah, blah, blah. And I contacted a few other publishing places, and the prices to produce were just astronomical for what I wanted. And I didn't want to do a half project. I didn't want to just go, well, let's do it digitally and cheap and bang it out. I thought, I want this to be as genuine to the sketchbooks as possible. So the paper has to be this really beautiful cream, hardback, spot UV, matte laminated, really beautifully finished book. So I was getting all these costs back from other printers, and it was just like, wow, eye-watering. It's like, that's a huge amount. And then, yeah, I got in contact with Biddles, and they were genuinely lovely people, family-run. And they said, we'll do it for this, and this is what you're going to get. And I thought, I want to work with you, because you're like, you know, they weren't cheap, but they were pretty good on cost. Because I was self-funding as well, I couldn't just go, well, here's 100 grand, so let's just go mad, you know. So yeah, I found the printers. And then the other thing that people don't see behind the scenes, so they say, Vic Lee, Corona Diary, he drew it and then he printed it and then he sent it, and that's it, and now we have it and it's here. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, I had to speak to the Royal Mail. I had to have business accounts, DHL. I had to go through so many business situations and try and get, how do I post it? Where do I do? How many did I have to order? I mean, honestly, you have no idea how much stress and sleepless nights I had whilst the book was being printed. Probably 6 to 8 weeks of maybe 3 hours sleep a night, and then waking up going, I gotta do this, oh my god. It was insane. And then the books arrived, 4 tons of books arrived on our driveway, which we then had to move into the house. So our entire house was pretty much filled with books, which I then had to then unbox, or with my partner unbox, sign each one, and then repackage into packaging that I'd obviously also had to order and source, and then bag up, do all the paperwork for the Royal Mail on a day-to-day basis, drive to the Royal Mail, drop it off, get that stamped, go back, start again for the next day. So it was incredibly hard work to do, but it was also, once the books started arriving, with people's destinations around the world, it suddenly everything became more real for me, and the comments were just amazing, just brilliant. And I think I cried a few times, so it was quite an emotional thing to do.
Yeah, I can imagine. And what a story as well, something that you've created in this time and fulfilled a need that lots of people probably quite grateful for to have. And how many books have you sold at the moment?
So the first edition sold out. So that sold out in 8 weeks. So that was 2,500 books, and each one was signed. So that was all self-published. The first book got picked up by Francis Lincoln. They loved it. And I'd been in contact with loads of publishers before this to say, I've done this book, it's a bestseller, it's great. And everyone's like, yeah, no one's going to read about coronavirus in a year's time. And I thought, yeah, you don't know the half of this, do you? And then Francis Lincoln picked it up. We were actually driving. Our friends gave us this little place in France, and we thought, let's just go to France for a month and take off and breathe a bit. We never saw anyone. It was in the middle of this little tiny village. And on the way there, Francis Lincoln got in contact. So over the next sort of 5 weeks, we were in conversation and then dealing with the legal side of things. And then on the way back after 5 weeks, it had actually gone to print. So if you know about publishing, publishers won't launch a book for a year. So they'll basically sign a book and then it will stay whilst they're working all the logistics out and everything, and it will be released the year later. So for Francis Lincoln to pick it up and turn it around and go to print pre-Christmas was absolutely nuts. But I felt like I wanted to get it out there, maybe further afield, which is great. And I could never have done what they've done, which is amazing. But the second book, I think I'm just going to keep as an artist edition for the time being, just because I want to keep it a bit more special, I think, for now anyway.
And have you released the second book, or are you still thinking?
Pre-orders. So it's pre-orders again, seeing how it goes. It's gone to print this week, and it will take about 5 weeks to print. And then they'll start going out in springtime. And then I'll start all over again. My daily runs to the post office. So yeah, more for me, but it's my life now, I think.
Yeah, you're our storyteller. We need to keep producing it, and also, like, when do you stop? Because I've started a project called Post Quarantine, where we invite people to write letters to their future selves.
Nice.
And to reunite people with their letters at the end and have a big party in a gallery. And we've spoken about, okay, at what point do we stop the project and then reunite everyone with their letters? I mean, have you thought about when you're going to stop with Corona Diary, or are you just going to keep that?
No, I think I've stopped it now. I mean, the first one I did from the 1st of January to the 1st of June. And the 1st of June, a lot of countries were coming out of lockdown and things were sort of getting back to normal. So I thought, hopefully this will be the end of it. And obviously I started the second one in September, going back, because I thought this is just getting worse. You know, it's not getting better. It's getting worse, if anything. And then you've got all the political side of things that were happening. One of the things that I felt I needed to do with the first diary, there's a little bit in the diary to do with Marcus Rashford. So I read about Marcus back in, a month. I think it was in April 2020. And Marcus was doing loads of work for Fair Share. And the supermarkets were getting involved and donating food that was near the sell-by date, which was great. So it's like this £20 million thing that was going on. So I included that in the book because I thought Marcus Rashford, what an amazing young guy. So when the first book sold out, I thought I need to do something. I can't just say, well, this is all mine. So I donated £5,000 of my own money to Fair Share, and I thought I need to do something positive. So I got in contact with Fair Share, and I donated £5,000 to them. I didn't really think too much of it. I just thought, well, it's just a thing to do, isn't it? It's what you do when things have gone well. You give a little bit back to people that need it. And obviously, with my background, council estate, child allowance, single parent. It was, I would have been one of these people that would probably have been suffering now if it had happened back in the 70s. And Fair Share were great. The 5,000 would I think it ended up buying like 20,000 meals for people that needed it, which was incredible. And I also donated a selection of number of books to key workers that I met whilst I was coming to the studio and people that I'd met. So our postman, the ladies in Sainsbury's, my local Sainsbury's, the bin men who collected our bin, I just gave them one of the artist's copy each and said, just to say thank you and have a read, because you probably are the sort of silent people that kept everything together, really. So I think it's really important to give something back. Obviously, you've got your Jeff Bezos, who obviously wants to build a rocket and keep all the money for himself. But as a human being, I think it's important to say, I don't need this. I'm just going to spend it on shoes and rubbish when it can go somewhere more important.
Yeah, that is amazing, actually. That link back to, as you said, your childhood, your own experience, and how you were able to give back and support other people. And do you think that you're, because of that, there may have been a political persuasion in the book towards your own?
how do you mean political persuasion?
Not political persuasion, but obviously, sorry, that's quite a challenging question, actually. Sorry to like drop that question bomb on you, but obviously that was the Conservative Party had done something which meant that he had to step up and feed.
I think there's this thing that people will probably look at the first book and the second book as me maybe being a little bit sort of negative towards the Conservative Party. It's not to do with that. You know, if any party was in power, Labour, Lib Dem, Green, and they did all the things that Boris Johnson's government have done, I would have equally have gone to town on them. Yeah. And I think that's the thing, really. It's not a political book. It's a book. These are books about what actually happened and what's been going on. It's not, I don't like this group of people. I don't dislike them. I just don't like the way they handled everything. Yeah. Because it doesn't really affect them very much. It affects, you know, the everyday people. So no, it's not political. It's just a comment on what occurred, basically.
Yeah, it's just observation, really, of everything, and you just documenting it and putting it in the book.
Yeah, I mean, everything in the book, both books, are readily available to read in most news networks. And, you know, it's not, there are a few, I tried to keep it non-political. There's a few pages that I had to change because it was like, I'm just ranting now. So I thought, I can't put that in. Because I don't want to get, you know, I don't want to become too personal in that respect. So I took a few pages out. But the rest is just, it's just what happened, really. I want this to be a book that people can look back on and go, oh, I remember that, or oh, I didn't know about that. I think it's a nice way to actually get people to maybe start talking about stuff. The planet as a whole, pollution-wise. In the second book, there's a page which it talks about the Earth Overshoot Day, which I'd never heard of, and I think most people have never heard of, basically. And it's when human beings use the Earth's natural resources that it can produce in 1 year, and basically we pretty much use them up within about 6 months. So we're going backwards. We're actually destroying the earth by the amount of rubbish we're producing.
Yeah, it's scary stuff. But I just noticed the time, and
yes,
got 10 minutes for the Q&A section. But Vic, thank you so much. I really enjoy talking to you and
asking
questions. So Valentina has said, how does writing and illustrating the second diary compare with doing it the first time? Is it harder, easier the second time round?
So that's a good one. So the first book, I think, was a novelty to begin with. And then when I finished it, I thought, I'm not going to ever do another one of those ever again, because it was pretty much just whacked me out. And then I think it was when we were away in France, and because we were just relaxing and I'm not very good at relaxing, I thought, well, maybe I'll just draw a few pages, you know, maybe look back at what happened in June. And that's how it sort of started. The second one was more difficult to do because of what was going on politically, and because of, I guess, the cronyism that was occurring in the government. Mm. And the situation suddenly became quite, I was getting more angry because of the injustice and the fact that people were actually starting to use the coronavirus as financial gains. And you just can't get away from that, unfortunately. Because of the amount of stuff that I was reading, it was almost like everything just led back to people just trying to make money. And obviously the situation in the States, the world went mad after June, and like literally went absolutely mad, and it's still going mad. But fortunately it's sort of coming back a bit, and I hope things do start calming down. But yeah, I'd say the second book was harder.
I know exactly what you mean, Vic, about like the world going mad. I remember thinking as well, everyone was watching the elections in America. We were like, we know what this means if Trump gets back in again. And we were just all tuned in, and everyone around the world was holding their breath. And then the minute that Biden won, I remember this, the relief and laughing. I remember laughing like a hysterical crazy person, like, oh my god, yes. And then all of a sudden just the pressure just released. It's like fizzy like pop, and then just go and just release it a little bit, and you think, okay, what else is going to happen now as a to this, and what it shift back the trajectory, because it just went so far one way and something had to give, it had to go back at some point, and it was a relief when it did.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think when the when I was reading about what was happening at the Capitol on the 6th of January, it was weird because it was, I think, because there was so much, because of what was happening there, all the news was focused on what was happening in the States and the takeover of the Capitol building. But because it was so far away from the UK, I suddenly felt lighter. I felt like I didn't have to worry about coronavirus because there was something else worse happening so far away from where I was living. Mm. And it was almost like, are we now just looking for the next worst thing to look at to take the pressure off how we're dealing with the situation here and now, that we need something bigger and scarier to say, well, at least that's not happening to me. Thank God for that. It's a really weird situation that we're in the fact that we're, you know, I don't really see a way out of anything at the moment, but I think what happened in the States was definitely a positive, and that made me feel like I've got something to look forward to because there's something good that's happened.
Yeah, definitely. What advice would you offer the current crop of creative students, graphic design and illustration students?
So I always say, I think if I went back to my past, if I went back to how I kind of started, is don't rush. There is no rush. Why do you want to rush to be successful? You're going to miss all the good stuff in between. Go out and enjoy your life. Enjoy what you do. You know, I traveled around the world. I was a stateroom steward. I cleaned toilets for 3 years of my life. But I saw the world and I loved it. You know, I was a postman, decorator, billiard table restorer. My God, what else did I do? Shop assistant. I did loads of things, and that's all my history, you know. I went to college when I was older, wiser, maybe more dedicated, and I became an illustrator when I was 44. And it's almost like I've really enjoyed every decade, and every year, every decade has got better and better and better and better. If I'd have become an illustrator straight away, I think I'd be bored now. I think I'd be like, well, okay, I've done it now. You know, what do I do now? It's a bit like if you're famous when you're 17, you then, like, if you're like a reality star, you then have to be that reality star till you're 70.
Yeah.
You know, and it's almost like, why not be a reality star when you're 35 or 40, and then you can just gradually just move into that, you know. Slow down, don't rush, enjoy life, experience as much as you can. Once this is all gone and over, travel, see the world. The world's an amazing place. You'll meet unbelievable people, cultures, flavors, and you'll experience things you'll never experience, and then bring it back and use that as your petrol for life.
Yeah, and that's such great advice, because whatever makes a great creative is the life experiences that they've had that goes into their work, and the observations, and then communicating that. It's a communication, really, being an illustrator or graphic designer. And if you don't really have much to communicate from life experience, then is your work going to be as strong as it could be? if you
Exactly. And that's the same as photography and music as well. You know, I've got photography friends who I look at some of their pictures from, you know, when they do projects around the world, and I'm just like, wow, this is crazy. It's inspiring. The work, you shouldn't be stuck in a bubble. I think the biggest thing I'd say is don't rush life, because it's, you don't make it boring, make it interesting, and don't rush to be successful, because once you've reached it, you've got nothing to aim for.
Yeah, really good advice. So next question is from Alex, which is, do you carry a sketchbook with you at all times and draw ideas coming into your head instantly?
No, I don't. So I'm doing this thing later. So every Thursday for the next 4 weeks, I'm doing it's my way of giving back. I'm doing a little Instagram live for kids and kidults, and it's basically talking about drawing. So last week I was talking about materials that I use and pens and stuff like that. I don't carry sketchbooks wherever I go. I started doing the diary based on my travel diaries. So about 10 years ago, I started these things called travel diaries, where I would sit on the beach or wherever I was, and I would draw all the people that I'd met and the places that I'd been and the little stories and how much everything cost. And these would go on for many, many, many pages. So I just sit and I draw wherever I go. But what I do is I try and remember things when I go out. So if I'm in a restaurant, I'll be looking around and I'll be like, okay, I've got to remember what I'm eating. I've got to remember the sign, the people. I've got to remember this environment so that I can draw it later. And then it ends up being this. I don't know if you can see that.
That's amazing, yeah. Just the detail and the intricacy and just, yeah.
Yeah, so these are basically just A4 pages that I've stuck together. So it's pretty much using your memory as your sketchbook, if you like. But I think for Alex, I'd say if you take out a sketchbook, turn your phone off, or just put your phone to one side. And if you're out and about and you see something, just sketch it, draw it. And you'll remember it if you go back through the sketchbook. You'll remember it more than a photograph, which you'll ignore for 10 years. So just draw whenever you're out and about and sketch.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Vic, for your time and answering all those questions. And it was just so much information there. And I hope everyone felt very inspired, because that was a great, great talk.
Thank you, Nikki. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Take care, everyone. Thank you for tuning in.